Hey everyone, thanks for joining us on the Week in Review. I'm Paris Schutz. The temperature is rising as the polls get closer in the race for Chicago mayor.
How do you expect the city to grow and prosper, particularly its poorest communities, when you're talking about defunding the police?
I'm not going to defund the police. And you know that. You know that.
The attacks come fast and furious. Vallis hits Johnson for past defund the police comments, and Johnson criticizes Vallis' tenure leading public school systems. Jurors hear recordings showing how former House Speaker Madigan operated in week one of the ComEd 4 trial. At CPD, it's over and out for David Brown as First Deputy Eric Carter takes over. TASE of Chicago moves to September to avoid colliding with NASCAR. And in sports,
open three.
Northwestern moves on to round two of the NCAA tournament while the Fighting Illini go home. And the Bears sign a bevy of free agents but stay on the sidelines as high-priced players go elsewhere. We're going to get to all of that now to our Week in Review panel. Joining us are John Seidel of the Chicago Sun-Times, Laura Washington of the Chicago Tribune and ABC 7 News, A.D. Quigg of the Chicago Tribune, and Lawrence Holmes from 670 The Score and sports columnist at the Chicago Sun-Times. Let's get right into it. Let's start with the news of the day, Laura Washington. Brandon Johnson gets the Chuy Garcia endorsement today. Does that move the needle with Latino voters?
We'll have to see. Chuy Garcia didn't do as well as you might have expected him to do in the first round, and of course that's why he's not in the runoff. But this is a big endorsement. This is probably the biggest endorsement of the campaign so far. Chuy Garcia was very popular. He was in runoff against Rahm Emanuel. I think it was really important for them to send a message that progressives were coming together, were unifying around one candidate. That gives them a lot. That gives Johnson a lot more momentum in terms of bringing the progressive vote out. And we'll have to see if Garcia gets out and campaigns with him. I think that's going to be really important.
He wasn't campaigning so much when he was running for mayor because he was in Congress. And Lawrence Holmes, Vallis has touted his own multiracial group of aldermen in his corner endorsing him. Johnson, as you would expect, as we mentioned, the progressive groups. How does this translate to votes?
That's what I've been trying to figure out. I agree with you. Like, talking about Chuy Garcia, how do you get some of the votes that I think that Chuy may have left on the table, and how do you get them to vote for Brandon Johnson? I looked at the coalition of people who didn't make it to the final and said there was an opportunity for Brandon Johnson to go and try to get all of those votes. But then you started to see the endorsements go the other way in some of the cases, like Jamal.
And that was a surprising one.
I was shocked.
Jamal Green supporting Vallis.
Because he went so hard after Brandon Johnson in so many of those debates for not being a true West Sider, for not really speaking for black Chicagoans. I kind of thought he might not have endorsed at all, but he ultimately went for
Vallis. Well, that would make more sense because it's not like Paul Vallis is necessarily speaking for black Chicagoans.
Right.
And Jamal Green was asked about this at the press conference about whether or not there had been some quid pro quo. He kind of danced around it, but Vallis is promising him all kinds of initiatives, like an office for African Americans in City Hall, kind of thing.
But
so
let's be
clear. That's his rationale.
Jamal Green does not have a big known constituency.
No,
he did not have a big
percent. Over 2% of the vote.
And Roderick Sawyer endorsed Paul Vallis. He had 0%. So what kind of constituency is that? John Seidel, Vallis is continually attacking Johnson for, in the past, talking about defund the police. Do you think that's a blow that is landing with voters?
I don't know if it's I think it's probably landing with some. I mean, there seems to be a clear difference, just as somebody who's been watching this campaign, between the law and order candidate and the perceived defund the police candidate. I know that Brandon Johnson has distanced himself from that claim, but I can certainly see why Paul Vallis wants to continue to hammer away at that point and set himself, because crime has been such an issue in the campaign. Right?
And Laura Washington, Johnson is trying to distance himself, saying, I never said that, even though there are recordings where he pretty much does say that. Do you think that that's working, that he's trying to disassociate himself with that?
Well, he has to, because that when he said those things one or two or three years ago, the defund the police movement was much stronger, was much more popular, particularly with progressives. That's fading because of some of the things you're talking about, because of crime. So he has to show that he is not planning on dramatically cutting police services. But he's been kind of weak on that. He says, he's going to hire 200 detectives. Those detectives are going to have to be promoted from the lower ranks, and he's not talking about whether he's going to replace those people. He's not committing to replacing all the police vacancies, more than 1,000 of them. And he's talking about cutting $150 million from the police budget. He says it's going to be administrative costs. But that raises questions about maybe he's not defunding, but he's certainly not eagerly funding.
He was damaged in the first round of the mayoral election because he had people basically painting him as a socialist. And it was Lori Lightfoot and Paul Vallis who were doing it. So with Vallis, he's just continuing what had started in the first round of this. And now it's up to Johnson to try and push what he was actually, or at least what he's claiming, it was his actual agenda with the police. I don't know if it's going to work, especially considering where you start looking at the heat map of the votes that Vallis got. It's probably not going to convince those people that that's not what he meant. It's a great cudgel for Vallis to use to distance himself and make a clear difference in who they are.
And that's why it keeps coming up in nearly every debate. A.D. Quigg, Vallis, it seemed, was spared from the worst of the attacks during the primary because everyone said they wanted to face Paul Vallis. They didn't think he would win in this runoff. But now you see Vallis kind of turning the heat up on Brandon Johnson, where he was more restrained in the beginning. Is that a reflection of polls showing this race really tightening?
Yeah, Laura was just telling me as we sat down, there's a new one out that shows them within a couple of points of each other with, I think, 10% undecided, margin of error of 4%. So, yeah, it's closer than it was on election night when they had 10, 15 between them. And, yeah, in early debates, we saw Paul Vallis basically ignore a lot of the attacks that Brandon Johnson was lobbying at him. Now we're seeing a little bit of that return, a little bit more of Paul Vallis going after him for lack of budget experience for his tax plan and, of course, for the defund the police stuff.
But the attack on Vallis is that he actually has a poor track record, according to Brandon Johnson, trying to turn around all these school systems, CPS, New Orleans, Philadelphia, et cetera. What's the reality of that record?
Well, Johnson brought some people up from New Orleans and from Philadelphia yesterday and had them at a press conference to talk about what they say are some of the controversies that he brought in, charter schools and basically ruined access to public education, that some of his actions led to a lot of layoffs. And, this is human live testimony, and we've heard this before. Vallis has been controversial in every school system he's worked on. There's no doubt about that. I thought it was interesting that Vallis hit on Johnson's experience last night because there hasn't been a lot of conversation about his lack of experience. Johnson is a Cook County commissioner. He's never managed anything. He was a teacher before that. And I think that's an area you're going to see Vallis hit a lot harder on.
And Johnson's still an active still paid, I believe, by the Chicago Teachers Union as an organizer. He, of course, is getting millions more from the Teachers Union and other organized labor. Vallis is getting all his money or the bulk of it from the LaSalle Street crowd. Right. What does that tell you about where we're headed over the next 3 weeks?
I think it tells you business folks are freaked out about the taxes that Brandon Johnson is proposing. It tells you that CTU thinks this is a now or never moment to finally elect one of their own to lead the city of Chicago. Today we saw charter schools also getting involved in this race, spending upwards of $600,000 opposing Brandon Johnson. I think we're really going to see the message kind of define itself in these next couple weeks, and people who are freaked out are going to spend a lot of money.
All right, let's move on to some of the other biggest stories of the week. Police Superintendent David Brown departs. Eric Carter takes over on an interim basis. Mayoral candidates Paul Vallis and Brandon Johnson talk autonomy for city council. Nonprofits get the right to unionize. The trial of so-called ComEd 4 is officially underway, and closures for NASCAR push Taste of Chicago back to September 1st at John Seidel. David Brown is officially gone. He left with no fanfare. It's almost like he snuck out of the building. Does that kind of indicate there's no love lost here between him and the city of Chicago?
Exactly. No, I don't think so. I think people were waiting for him to leave. I think it was expected, right? I mean, I think all the candidates, except for Lori Lightfoot, said that they were going to fire him. So when she lost, he left. And it's going to be really interesting to see this new process that I think we have for searching for a new police superintendent. I believe we're going to have a nationwide search, and won't necessarily be in line with what the candidates want.
And I want to get to that in a second, but Lawrence Holmes, when David Brown came in, he said he was going to bring homicides down to 300. Now, we had a pandemic. Homicides went up in every city across the nation. Reform was slow to happen under Brown. Morale has been really low under David Brown. Are these things a big part of his legacy?
Yes, 100%. If you look at both the mayor and the superintendent, explain to me who their constituency is, because I think that you'll find that citizens of Chicago didn't like the superintendent and the rank and file in the police department didn't like the superintendent. So who exactly was he to the city? And I think that obviously things were so difficult during the beginning of the pandemic that you saw some hard choices be made, but those hard choices then ended up being the wrong choices. The lifting of the bridges, I'll never get over that. Like, as a resident of the South Side, the way that it cut people off from being able to get back to the South and the West Side was really harmful. And then afterwards, there was the summer lunch program that got shut down for a couple of days afterwards. And those are things that people remember. Those are people on the South and West Side truly remember about his tenure as superintendent.
Yeah, sort of the images of those bridges lifted for that weekend are ingrained in people's memories.
It felt like property was being protected more so than people.
Laura Washington.
I was always mystified why the mayor didn't jettison him earlier. And what I heard from her people was that she didn't have a lot of other good choices. There's just not that many people in the country. We're going to see how that search goes that can handle this kind of a big city police department. But it was clear from day one he got off on the wrong foot. He was not, you talk about people not liking him, he was never out in the community, rarely out in the community, as compared with his predecessor, Eddie Johnson, who, of course, had his problems, but was very engaged, very committed to in community engagement and being seen on the street.
I have to say, from personal experience, in the very beginning, he was pretty accessible to the mm-hmm. press. It's like he wanted to be out there. As those numbers got really bad, you couldn't find him anywhere. That was just my own experience, and I think a lot of other reporters had that experience, too. Meanwhile, Eric Carter, the deputy, takes over John Seidel. He's someone, too, that the rank and file has had problems with. So what do we expect going forward?
Well, yeah, I don't know. I think that both Brandon Johnson and Paul Dallas have said that they want to find someone from within the rank and file. I think the rank and file want that. I think there are traditionally problems when outsiders come in. But we do have a new process for conducting a search, a community based a community group, and you know, I think Laura and AD could talk more about that, but I think they've said that they're not necessarily going to listen to Paul Vallis or Brandon Johnson, whoever's the mayor, and just search within the rank and file. They want to look across the country, and I think they have till sometime in July to do so.
And this is really interesting, because this is an interim commission. Mm-hmm. The ordinance set this up, and at some point people will be selected for permanent seats on this commission, but this commission in the interim says we are going to start the process, mm-hmm. find three finalists for superintendent. Do you read the ordinance to say that they do have this authority now?
Yes.
So this, and do you think the mayoral candidates are going to heed the choices that they put in front of them?
I think if they don't, it would be a big repudiation of everything that was fought for in the wake of Laquan McDonald's death. The reason we have this community commission in the first place, it was called like the third leg of reform to actually have a community voice at the table. So if they didn't, it would be a bad look. That's not to say there isn't precedent. Rahm Emanuel tossed out the police board picks when he chose Eddie Johnson. But it would be a bad look. And John's right, they did really assert their independence this week when the search began. We tried to ask them four different ways, do you care what these mayoral candidates are saying about who they want? They basically said, no.
But per this ordinance, the mayor can reject the three finalists and say, go start the process over again and bring me another three. Alderman also this week proposed rules that would give city council some more independence from the mayor, some more autonomy. The mayoral candidates weighed in on this. Let's hear what they had to say.
As the mayor of the city of Chicago, I get to set the tone for the entire city. And yes, I will work with the city council to figure out an infrastructure that provides the type of balance of responsibility, not a balance of power.
I'm talking about institutionalizing the city council's authority so that they can challenge the mayor. Because right now we live in an imperial mayor system where whatever comes from the fifth floor is almost automatically approved by the city council.
So what's being talked about here is having the city council appoint their own committee chiefs. The mayor has always had leverage to do that, and some other things that would just give the city council more of a voice here and not be beholden to the mayor. Is this good
sure
proposal?
Sure, it is. I think the mayor, whoever the mayor is, will have some influence on how that vote goes, and these committee chairs have to be approved by the entire city council. I'm skeptical. I don't think any mayor gives up power, especially a brand new mayor. So I think that. If the council really pushes hard on these changes, I think you could see maybe the predecessor for another council wars period like we had back in the 80s, which wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing.
For reporters, of course, Lawrence Holmes. I mean, is it be careful what you wish for? A more empowered city council, you know, maybe they have a voice, but things get clogged up versus things got done under a strong mayor, weak council system.
I've been going back and forth on this and, like, listening to the council members and what they say. And I think it's really interesting that you have Vallis saying, oh, absolutely. And then you have some of the people that are endorsing him kind of looking at, well, we need to look at this. And that's fascinating to me. I think that what we're seeing is, how do we want government to work? And that's a big question. It's a really big question at the municipal level, the state level, and at the national level. How do we want government to work? And no one seems to be able to agree on how that goes.
And sometimes I wonder if city council really wants that empowerment, because it means they actually have to stick their neck out and do things. That,
well, and organize themselves, which we saw during the remap process was not easy. And I think some of the pushback we're seeing from other aldermen who have either endorsed Vallis or Johnson or no one is they have some reticence because they're not in the room as it's being debated. And there's some pushback from folks who say this is self-preservation on account of the people who currently have committee chairmanships. So we'll see what happens in the next few weeks. And these rules also have to get reapproved when the new city council comes in. So I'll be very interested to see what these new aldermen think.
What, 16 seats left that still need to be decided?
14 runoffs, I think, we've finally gotten down to after the certification.
So it's likely that anything, if they do move ahead with a vote before the next mayor is seated, that's probably going to have to be reconsidered and looked at again. And one questions, and I think some of the good government people have said, what's the big hurry? Why are we moving ahead to reorganize now? Why don't we wait until we see what this full new city council will look like after these runoffs?
For a lot of issues like the ComEd franchise agreement. And speaking of ComEd, John Seidel, how about that transition? Week one of the ComEd 4 trial. First of all, remind our viewers, what exactly is at stake here?
The freedom of four former ComEd officials and lobbyists who are accused of trying to bribe former Speaker Madigan to get legislation passed.
And we're looking at the four of them right now. So jurors heard some audio recordings. You heard them too this week. You heard Madigan. You kind of got a glimpse into how things got done with Madigan and his top lieutenant, Mike McLean. What did you listen to?
The first recordings came in yesterday, and they came in with former State Representative Lou Lang on the stand. And this had to be, you know, talking to people afterward about it, I think they all agree this had to be kind of an embarrassing episode for Lou Lang sitting there, because what jurors heard was Michael McLean, who's always been very close to Michael Madigan, calling him in the midst of a Me Too scandal. There had already been allegations against Lou Lang. He had been cleared, but apparently there was somebody else talking about coming forward. And Michael McLean got on the phone with Mike Madigan and said, Madigan said, I don't think he can continue on. And McLean asked him, when do you want me to go ahead and lower the boom? And Madigan said sooner or later. So McLean gets on the phone with Lou Lang. And Lou Lang has had decades of experience in the legislature. He's a leader in Madigan's caucus. And Mike Madigan was not the person to call and tell him that his career was over. And Lou Lang acknowledged on the stand that he aspired to be the Speaker of the House one day. And instead he gets a call from Michael McLean, who's basically telling him it's time to go.
And Lang is acknowledging that once he knew that Madigan was saying this, he says, oh, yep, I know that it's over. But what are prosecutors hoping to get out of this testimony as it relates to the ComEd 4?
Right. So here's the point, is that prosecutors say that Michael McLean passed along demands to ComEd on behalf of Michael Madigan. And so in these tapes, you hear Michael McLean describing himself as an agent of Madigan. And you don't only hear that, you hear Michael McLean on the phone with Madigan discussing what they're going to do, and Madigan giving him the signal sooner rather than later, right, to go and tell Lou Lang that it's time to go. So what jurors heard was that Michael McLean does apparently act as an agent for Mike Madigan, as prosecutors said.
Okay, so they're establishing that. A lot more to go in this very fascinating case. So Taste of Chicago. Now it's going to be in September because to accommodate the NASCAR race, Lawrence Holmes, you happy about that as a Chicagoan?
No, I am not happy
You're a sports guy. Are you happy that NASCAR is here?
Well, I mean, NASCAR was in Joliet for forever. I mean, it was fine. It was perfectly fine there. You know what they had? They had a track.
They've never done a city road course.
They could just do that. They could go around in circles out there in Joliet. I think that this deal... It feels like to me and no one's told me this, but it feels like to me that the city is trying to show that they could hold a road race so that they could eventually get to F1, Formula One racing, which is a higher profile event, which would bring tons of money into the city. But this just seems haphazard. And it strikes me almost like the parking meter deal, where it's like you farmed out the city for 3 weeks and for 3 years. That's ridiculous. And then having to go about moving Taste of Chicago and kind of not knowing where to put it, when to do it, how to do it, all of the other things that are going to cut people off from the lakefront and the museum campus. You have the Art Institute saying that they've got to spend a lot of money to just secure the art of our city. They have to secure it because of the vibrations that the race is going to cause.
And you have the Shedd Aquarium saying we're going to lose tons of money because no one can get to our facility as this is going on. And Laura, 83 out of 87 days, Grant Park will be fully or partially closed to the public because of this.
Mainly with commercial events that theoretically are going to bring revenues to the city. The irony is that, you might be right, that the mayor wanted this to happen because she felt like it was an opening the door for even bigger things in the future. Ironically, she's going to be gone.
Right.
So she's left this mess. She didn't plan it very well. The move of Taste of Chicago to September, I think, is going to be very disastrous. I mean, we're talking about an iconic festival, the longest-serving festival we've had in the city. We're going to move to September. You know what weather can be like in Chicago in September?
It can be beautiful,
be chilly and rain, too. You know.
The advantage of having Taste in July was families were on summer break. You could bring your family to something like this. It was hot weather, like melting ice cream, corn on the cob.
People plan their vacations around this.
They plan their Robinson's ribs and their Eli's cheesecake.
And the turkey leg and all that stuff.
And the turkey leg.
I got to tell you, as someone who uses Lakeshore Drive as my primary way to get to and from, there's nothing I hate more than seeing those fences go up. It just makes our lakefront ugly.
Right. It just feels wrong. Lawrence, I got to get to sports. The Bears, a bunch of notable free agent signings this week, but they kind of avoided the really expensive marquee players. Is their roster better now than it was a couple weeks ago?
Oh, my God. They were the worst roster in the NFL. So anything that they could do to bring people in was going to make it better. But the trade that they made to get DJ Moore and the draft picks for the number one pick is a brilliant deal. These players that they brought in are better. Tremaine Edmonds is a fantastic linebacker. TJ Edwards is a kid who grew up loving the Bears. They actually have five players now that grew up loving the Bears on the Bears, which is fascinating to me. And Nate Davis, he allows them to have an upgrade. You can make an argument that of the 22 starters that played for the Bears last year, 16 of them need to be replaced. Doing that in one offseason is very difficult.
And Ryan Poles, the GM, has made that case. Meanwhile, it seems like you still need at least three out of the four positions on the defensive line replaced.
Yes.
He didn't go for some of those marquee players. What's his plan B?
Well, the plan B is the draft, and that's also difficult because the player that most people thought was a perfect fit for the Bears is a kid named Jalen Carter from University of Georgia. He was involved in a car accident that led to the death of two members of the University of Georgia football family. Now he is got 80 hours of community service, but he had his workout and he looked slow and sluggish, and you wonder how much of all of this stuff is affecting. They're going to have to build through the draft. Now, there's still going to be secondary and tertiary free agents that they can sign, but the draft is probably where they're going to have to go. This is a long process that Ryan Poles has embarked upon.
Yeah, it does seem like he's being patient and not falling into the trap of, like, let's make a big splash now and get saddled with the overpriced contract for the next several years.
The salary cap for the NFL is going to continue to increase because of the influx of money from streaming services. So the salary cap's going to rise. They're going to have money to keep going after free agents, and they still have a pretty big bounty right now. So the secondary, tertiary market of free agents is going to be helpful to them, and then, of course, the draft.
All right, we saw Boo Booey nail that three at the top of the show. Northwestern moving on to round two. How far realistically can they go?
This is about right for Northwestern this year, but this is a strange year for the NCAA tournament. This is a year where I feel like every team has a chance. Literally every team.
Furman.
And what's happened, Furman, you look and you say, look at that. That because of the way that the NCAA allowed for students to stay an extra year, because all of the COVID students get an extra year in the NCAA, it's meant that there's more veteran players. Like, there's one guy playing the tournament, I think he's 27 years old. Think about that. He's playing against 18 and 19-year-olds. it allows for teams to have a little bit more continuity. And in the cases where there isn't continuity, the transfer portal, which has been a big thing, topic of discussion in college basketball, has allowed teams to kind of bolster, like, I'm not getting playing time at Northwestern. Well, I'm going to transfer to Duke, or I'm going to transfer to North Carolina. By the way, that's something that happened. Like, think about that. The Northwestern basketball had two kids transfer to North Carolina and Duke. Who would have thought that we would have ever been in a place for that? But Chris Collins has done a great job. It looked like he was going to be on the hot seat, and now his team has made it, has a chance to go to the Sweet 16 with a win.
So very quickly, someone that may be on the hot seat, Brad Underwood at Illinois, disappointing.
I mean, it's disappointing. I think Brad's fine. Like, he still recruits. They're top half of the Big Ten team, of Big Ten conference. I think he'll be fine, but yeah, he got outcoached by Eric Musselman yesterday.
Yeah, Illini obviously getting bounced out of the first round. All right, we are out of time. We have to bounce out of here. So for John Seidel, Laura Washington, A.D. Quigg, and Lawrence Holmes, thank you so much for watching. That is our show for this Friday night. Don't forget, you can get Chicago Tonight and the Week in Review streamed on Facebook, YouTube, and our website, WTTW.com/news. And join us tonight at 10 for Chicago Tonight. And on the show, using the Red Line extension to spur community-driven development. And powerful work and an exhibition from war-impacted artists. Now for all of us, the Week in Review, I'm Paris Schutz. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and we will see you at 10. Lawrence, you know, we've got spring training. We have baseball 2 weeks away, and yet on sports radio, it's Bears, 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 Bears. And I'm not complaining, by the way.
I was talking with John about this. I was saying how
it's amazing
with the Bears being as bad as they were. We actually had,
it's like an ounce of hope.
Yeah, that's all you need.
But people, it's 365 days a year now we talk
about
the NFL.
The NFL moves the needle. It economically,
ratings,
and from a rating standpoint.
And we didn't even get to Lonzo Ball and the Bulls. Is he ever going to play?
I'm concerned that this surgery that he's having now is more about quality of life than it is about him returning to the Bulls, which I hope he's okay. But three surgeries in 14 months is not a good thing.
Did the Bulls drop the ball?
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that's proud to serve its community through pro bono legal services.